This is the Takeaway Podcast for Monday, August 24th, 2015. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you are joining us at Colorado Public Radio in Denver. You're going to meet the mayor later this hour. Later this week, you'll meet the governor. We'll hear about innovation above and below the ground here in this state that we will be exploring in conjunction with a state summit meeting of the Colorado Innovation Network, or COIN. This week's theme is curiosity. And we'd love to know when curiosity led to discoveries bad or good in your lives. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And speaking of curiosity, we also will look at the beginning of the fallout from the hack that has made public the private indiscretions of people of all walks of life, except it turns out at the Vatican, more about that later, but Washington, D.C. is experiencing a tsunami of Ashley Madison Gate. Some senior policy officials in some highly sensitive positions revealed as members of that adultery website. But first, it's more like free fall than freestyle on Wall Street today, a day of potentially record turbulence and volatility that comes after a dreadful week where China's slowdown and its apparent inability to deal with its own currency troubles have caused a wave of selling in everything from commodities to stocks. Are these normal business cycles, or is there a vulnerability of the financial system we're not seeing? Jason Abruzzese is business reporter at Mashable. Jason, is China leading the way here?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're seeing some really bad signs, particularly their stock market. It just continues to decline. It's down almost 40% from its peak. And on top of that, there's just broader concerns that, you know, it's the second largest economy in the world. And the growth that it's been seeing for years, you know, double-digit growth, is starting to slow.
And if that growth slows, there is no place to make up for it. Even though the U.S. is growing, even though Europe may have stabilized, there's certainly no demand like the 10% or more than 7% growth that China was experiencing up until just a few months ago.
That's absolutely correct. And on top of that, you know, what we're seeing with China and the softness in its economy really does filter down to some of the other emerging economies in the world, which also have been growing pretty rapidly. So not only do you have the world's largest economy starting to slow down with its growth, you also have some of the other growth drivers, South America, other parts of Asia that are getting affected by that as well.
Brazil is certainly inflamed with its own political problems. We'll talk about that a little later this hour. But it also seems that this has been a moment for Wall Street and stocks in the United States to suddenly take a good hard look at their balance sheets. And investors seem to be thinking that there's a lot of fiction there.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, we've seen some stock prices rise a little more rapidly than revenues or profits have. And at times like that, you know, there are certain people who pay attention to those fundamentals who will say, you know, that's a serious problem. It's certainly not the only factor to take into account. But, you know, at times like this, when we're starting to see some dips, that is one of the things that people start looking at very quickly as, you know, have we gotten a little too ahead of ourselves with our asset prices?
With the $40 a barrel oil, the energy sector is under pressure. It seems like the Apple magic is gone. The Google magic may be gone. How do you assess that?
Sure. I mean, I think particularly with Apple, you know, you look at companies that do big business in China, and that's one of them. You know, China has been a major growth driver for Apple's profits and especially their revenues in the last couple of years, and it's supposed to be going forward. If we start seeing softness there, that company, you know, certainly will be, you know, under pressure to find that and make up for that growth elsewhere. You know, oil prices are an interesting thing because that has also to do with a lot of global demand. You know, when the economy is doing very well, we see a lot of demand for oil, you know, which goes towards shipping and things like that. It's just an interesting primer to look at. With oil prices declining, there's a lot of people concerned that, you know, what we are seeing isn't just a market thing. It is an overall economic slowdown.
And an economic slowdown, they come, they go. Recessions are things that we're familiar with. But if we go back to 2008, 2009, it was driven by a whole class of assets which were suddenly determined to be worthless, the securitized mortgages. Is there an asset monster out there lurking here that could add an element here that could change this from simply a slowdown?
Yeah, that's somewhat a positive note that we don't really see anything right now that is clearly kind of in a bubble or, you know, overvalued kind of like those asset prices were. But at the same time, maybe that's the issue. Sometimes, you know, the worst ones are the ones you don't see coming. You know, there's nothing I've seen that people are pointing at saying, like, this is severely overvalued and kind of an inherent risk to the rest of the system. I think some people have looked at some tech valuations, companies like Uber and Airbnb, these tech startups that have had achieved huge valuations. Those could certainly end up being a a bit of a bubble that ends up bursting, or at least, you know, takes a few steps back. But the systemic risk of that is not, you know, on par this time. At least that's what people are hoping.
Business reporter at Mashable, Jason Abruzzese, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
When I made my way into Denver Mayor Michael Hancock's office yesterday, I already felt like I knew him.
Hello, this is Mayor Michael Hancock. Welcome to Denver, the Mile High City. Denver enjoys 300 days of sunshine each year. Have fun exploring our beautiful state.
There's Mayor Hancock's voice greeting me on the noisy tram at the Denver airport. His voice greets the millions of people who come through Denver International, and most of these people aren't even the voters who elected him by a landslide for a second term. Hancock's enthusiasm is infectious. He's the city's second African-American mayor, and he believes that even the racial tensions of the last 12 months in this country are an opportunity to change his growing city, a diverse community that he says is collectively feeling a moment where big things can happen, from progressive approaches to housing, public transit, and policing.
Denver, and just recent articles and analysis have shown, is one of the least taxed cities in this country based on the services that we receive. And we're proud of the fact that we can be fiscally responsible while also maintaining the highest quality of services for our residents in this great city. And we want to continue that. Although there comes a time when we have to have tough conversations about where we want to go in the future, and we're certainly having those now regarding the investment of our infrastructure, the investment of housing, and investment in transformative projects that allow us to compete on a more global level. And we have to be responsible, and I think the electorate expects us to, one, look at our current resources and make sure we're getting everything we can out of them and we're being good stewards, and only ask for what you can justify and prove will ultimately help us out in the end, and particularly in the long run.
So smart people taking action responsibly attracts growth.
I like to say you give smart people the information they need, they'll make good decisions. And I think the modeling of this region, the cooperation and collaboration you see within this region of 41 mayors who work together on a very regular basis, agreeing to take a look at, to be data-driven in their decision-making, certainly helps us to make good decisions and put good arguments before the people. And our people in this region have made good decisions. Not to say that we don't make mistakes at time or a time or two, but in reality, we have really worked hard to perfect the model of getting good information before the electorate.
The discussion this summer has been about racial tension, about law enforcement's disconnect with African-American communities, the idea that whites and blacks really aren't seeing this moment in the same way, and that some have offered a suggestion that, you know, maybe we need to recognize our history a little bit more. The president has hinted at this sometimes. There have been some tragic incidents where protesters have tried to make a point, but there seems to be a sense that we've come to the end of the road of just protest and just education, and that we've got to start having different kinds of conversations to understand race and racial tension. How do you see what's happened this summer? Because it's been an amazing summer.
I think what we're seeing is the manifestation of what many of us who consider ourselves history buffs and understand this great nation and how we've become as great a nation as we are. And that is that our young people in particular have become disconnected from our history. They don't study it as much as we had to study it as we came along. But here's the reality. We have a phenomenal history as a nation, one in which, yes, has been tragic in some respects, but should make us stronger and not weaker as we move forward. And it is becoming upon all of us to educate our young people as well as to remind the baby boomers and those of us who are in the middle, the Xers, that indeed our history has made us great and that we need to lean on that history and never forget it and have the conversations to make sure that we don't allow the generations that come behind us to be disconnected. We didn't wake up and all of a sudden African Americans were able to sit in the classroom on an equal level or sit in front of the theater on an equal level or sit in front of the bus at an equal clip. The reality is that we have seen the struggles, the pain, the hurt, and the blood for people of people who shed it for us to have this opportunity. That was drilled into me. And I think we have dropped the baton and handed it to the next generation. We are not where we want to be, but we are far from where we started. A lot of progress has been made. We need to get back to the basics and get back to educating our young people and making sure they understand the ultimate responsibility that they have. And that includes our police officers.
So as tragic as Ferguson and Baltimore and even some of the incidents in this community are, they are reminders as much as they are tragedies and regretful tragedies, yes, they are reminders that we have some ways to go in this journey.
Yes, not only reminders, but I think kind of a new benchmark in that, yes, the 50s and 60s were really the explosion, if you will, of the civil rights movement and pushing for, you know, the inherent rights, as Dr. King said, to live, dream, and succeed in this nation according to the Constitution and the promises that were made to the citizens of this country. Today, what you see is really the manifestation in terms of Ferguson and New York and other places, Cleveland, that we've seen, is really the barometer to say, you know what, we also have a civil rights movement that still needs to be handled. We still have economic inequalities. We still have educational inequalities that have to be righted. And as long as we have people who are less educated, have less access to the opportunities or to the economic mainstream of this nation, you're going to have these kind of problems because it's about survival and it's about by any means necessary. So the reality is that we have got to find a way to level the playing field when it comes to economics and when it comes to education.
Denver, in many ways, is the original Western boom town. I mean, you know boom here in Denver like very few people in America do. Can a boom town grow in the 21st century and provide housing for everyone, or is it going to be tall buildings, luxury housing, and everything else will get figured out later when there's homeless people in the streets?
We also know bus town as well, as we have seen the bus of the oil and gas industry in the early 1980s, as well as the bust of the dot-com industry in the mid to late 1990s. That really hurt Denver and lost a lot of ground. And what we have learned from that, and Federico Pena experienced it, Wellington Webb and Hickenlooper jointly experienced it based on their eras in which they serve. But the reality is we've all talked about creating a deeper bench, a more substantive and deeper economic system. And that's the only way that I know that we can withstand the volatility of the market and making sure we diversify our economic platform as much as we possibly can, not just temporary measures, but permanent measures that we will always keep in mind those who are not necessarily top of the scales, but the folks who actually do all of the day-to-day work in this city.
New York Knicks got Carmelo. Yes. Mets are here to destroy the Rockies, they say. Is Manning washed up?
You can have Carmelo. And we'll use the Mets as a learning lesson as the Rockies prepare to get better in seasons to come. And I think Peyton Manning is primed for one of his best seasons, not statistically, but I think, quite frankly, in finishing the task that he showed up to begin in June preseason. I've watched this team gone to practice. This is as deep as they've come, as balanced as they've become. They've been since Peyton's been here. And I think this, quite frankly, may be the year where the Denver Broncos win the Super Bowl.
Thank you very much, Mayor.
You bet. Good to see you.
As part of our visit to Colorado, that's Denver Mayor Michael Hancock speaking to me from his office in the state capitol. If states like Oklahoma and Massachusetts are political still pond water, calmly and reliably Republican or Democratic from year to year, then the state of Colorado these days swirls with the political rapids of the legendary river that bears its name. Republican in every presidential race from 1964 and then Democratic in 1992 for Bill Clinton, voting for Barack Obama in both 2008 and 2012. Statewide offices in Colorado are unpredictable in this decade, and 2016 looks to place Colorado in every candidate's electoral strategy. Megan Verlee is a political reporter in Denver with Colorado Public Radio. It joins me right here. Megan, welcome.
Thank you, John.
It must be refreshing to be in a state where you can't really predict what's going to happen either on the national stage or within the statewide offices or even locally.
Refreshing but exhausting. You can never take an election year off. There's always something hard fought.
And because the Colorado electoral vote, the size of it, makes it something of a swing state, it has to be in everybody's column depending on their strategy, are all politics national in Colorado?
I think a lot of politics are national. You definitely see that in our U.S. Senate races. They're not talking about Colorado-specific issues usually. They're talking about national issues. But there are a few things that are very local to Colorado that I think, especially in this upcoming presidential election, are going to weigh heavily. One is that we are one of the marijuana legalization states, and the next president will have a huge impact on the future of what is a growing industry here, to pardon the pun. Another is that we're a large public land state, and so administrative attitudes towards energy development, towards public lands policy, weighs heavily on the minds of Coloradans.
Morally, it seems as though there's a certain flexibility in Colorado. I can't quite place it, but Same-sex marriage came down without a lot of controversy here. Marijuana seemed to be like, oh, yeah, right, sure. What's going on with that?
There is a somewhat fabled libertarian streak in Colorado that I think is talked about sometimes more than it is actually seen. But we do have a slightly larger libertarian registration and voting population here. And on social issues, often, yes, the state will go a little further left, even than its elected officials. The elected officials were not thrilled to see legal marijuana, most of them. Similarly, gay marriage, which took longer to get here than a lot of other states, it kind of arrived without a lot of public hullabaloo. And on issues even like abortion, which can be very hot button, this is a state that has not passed any significant abortion restrictions in quite a while. So, yes, often the social issues tend to go a little bluer than the elected offices.
Colorado Springs was once a national focus of conservative ideology, and to a certain extent it still is. But within the state, is it more marginalized, or is it a competitor, a real power confronting Denver and its urban liberalism?
What you see when you look at the map of Colorado is that you have a real red center, as you mentioned, down in Colorado Springs that actually stretches up through this growing suburban belt right to the south suburbs of Denver, and then encompasses a lot of the rural areas. We have, there's a lot of Colorado that people think is in Kansas, big flat plains, not a lot of people, but very red. We have a growing energy region in the northeast that's very red and out on the western slope. But then you have Denver, very, very, very blue, and that continues in the northern suburbs all the way up to Fort Collins towards Wyoming. Really where elections get fought is on turnout from those two bases. How enthusiastic can you get your ground troops? And then a few swing suburbs on the west side of Denver and the east side of Denver where maybe there are just enough persuadable votes that you can tip things one way or the other.
I have a lot of friends here. I've spent a lot of time reading about Colorado. I look at the electoral results every year. And, you know, I come from Ohio. Ohio is a divided state, very divided. Everybody knows in what camp they're in and what camp they're not in. Colorado does not seem, even though you describe these different, you know, sort of red and blue places, does not feel divided.
I think in a large way, especially at the state level in Colorado politics, I've noticed a discomfort with too much overt partisanship. Our governor, John Hickenlooper, has really striven to be seen as nonpartisan as possible, although after 6 years, that's definitely something that I'm sure Republicans would disagree with at this point. But there is at least at the state level, a desire to be seen as working together. I think Coloradans have very little patience for purely political gridlock.
So does that mean that this state can produce leadership quality that can cross that partisan divide that translates nationally? Tell me some characters, and I don't know if Hickenlooper is one of them, but tell me about some characters in Colorado who represent this ability to personally bring the sides together.
Well, certainly. I cover our state capital, and through the recession, we were one of those states that did not breakdown around the budget. They got a budget passed each year, whether it was all one party in charge or split chambers. Our Senator Michael Bennett, U.S. Senator Michael Bennett, a Democrat, has been part of some of the bipartisan working groups.
Although he's got a tough re-election.
He does. It's going to really come down to who the Republicans can nominate. And we saw that in our last election. Our Democratic Senator Mark Udall was unseated by a Republican Congressman, Cory Gardner. Gardner was a very, very strong candidate. And if the party can put up another very strong candidate against Bennett, he'll have another tough run.
Well, it's going to be very, very interesting to see. Any predictions on what will happen in 2016?
Absolutely none.
Absolutely none. A very smart Megan Verlee, political reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Until last week, Dolly and James were the names most associated with Madison in Washington, D.C. But this week, it's Ashley. As two assistant U.S. attorneys, an information technology administrator in the executive office of the president, and a government hacker at the Homeland Security Department were among the 1,500 government employees found to be using the adultery website Ashley Madison from their work computers. At least one of the employees has responded to the claim, but he isn't even from D.C. He's Florida State Attorney Jeff Ashton, who spoke to reporters on Sunday.
I know it sounds bizarre to say that you are interested in looking at the site but not doing it, but that's the honest answer.
Others will decide how honest that answer is. Hackers made the Ashley Madison data public, but the Associated Press crunched that data to reveal a combination of recklessness, immorality, and a disregard for how they might be violating national security. Ted Bridas is news editor for the Washington investigative team at the Associated Press. Ted, what did you do to the data? How did you take this hack and turn it into something cross-referenceable that revealed identities?
We were a little reluctant to take at face value the list of subscribers that anyone could create an account using any name or email address. So we dove deeper into the data and noticed that Ashley Madison had recorded the incoming computer internet address, the IP address, for every subscriber who made a credit card transaction. So we compared that information with known address ranges of federal IP addresses on the internet, and were able to identify specific federal workers who were not only connecting to the site, but paying for the service, and also paying for it from within their office computers.
And paying for it means they were getting something in return, although it would be up to a prosecutor to determine, or I suppose a spouse, to determine if someone actually connected with another person. The information doesn't specifically identify other people these people might have encountered.
That's true. What we're looking at is our credit card transactions, in some cases, multiple months of paying $65 or $70 a month for access to the website.
And there's a category or a series of categories of individuals you are looking for here. You're looking for individuals who might be compromised in some way in terms of national security, individuals who have sensitive positions, whose behavior might have been reckless on the face of it. And then, of course, there are members of the military whose behavior, being adulterous, could also violate federal law.
That's right. The AP review was specifically intended to discover and identify people who may be susceptible to extortion or blackmail based on sensitive national security jobs. And we found a number of them: two assistant U.S. attorneys, an IT administrator inside the White House, a Justice Department division chief, a government hacker at the Homeland Security Department, a scientist at National Nuclear Laboratories, a number of foreign diplomats in the State Department.
And there were attempts to conceal their identities, which indicated that they understood that perhaps their position made them subject to a certain amount of oversight. But the level of concealment in some of the cases you looked at would have to be described as sophomoric at best.
Yeah, one of the great things about the AP analysis was that we identified federal government workers who were accessing the site using email addresses that were not federal government email addresses. So using throwaway or disposable emails with handles such as sexless marriage, soon to be single, or Latin lovers. Some Justice Department employees we noticed appeared to be using prepaid credit cards to try to preserve their anonymity. But since they were connecting to the service from inside the DOJ offices, we were able to walk that connection right back. I don't think the government realized that it could do the type of analysis that we had done, but we've already heard that some agencies are beginning that review process to consider whether, you know, whether clearances ought to be revoked or modified.
Ted Bridas, news editor for the Washington investigative team at the Associated Press. Thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
Ted says among the places not to have had any subscribers to the Ashley Madison site, according to the AP report, is the Vatican.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills, like calculus, CPR, and celestial navigation. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
The history of music is the story of strange and wonderful combinations. Take the Neptunes. Meet Timbaland. Neptunes and Timbaland meet Kev Marcus and Will Baptiste, violinists who within them swirl a melange of classical training, jazz, pop, and hip-hop. This is Black Violin. This track is called Not Invisible from Black Violin's latest album, Stereotypes, which drops this September. Kev Marcus and Will B say because the violin comes with a centuries-old musical legacy, it's the perfect tool for teaching kids that music has no stereotypes.
I mean, when we first started, we really had an approach like a rapper. When we dissect songs, like our lead song on our album, Stereotypes, we were like, okay, well, we're going to do an 8-bar hook and a 16-bar verse. Like, we don't think of it, I mean, you can think of it as ABA, you know, just like, traditional form and counterpoint. But for us, we were thinking, you know, like, you know, you take the first verse and I take the second verse and then, you know, we do the bridge together and then the hook is just, you know, some slamming hook. So we thought of it, we always think of it in form at the way pop musicians think about it, not just rappers, but pop musicians. So when you listen to our album, even a song that's completely instrumental, if you like popular music, you'll understand its form immediately. You know, the form of it will feel like any song you're used to hearing on the radio, even though it may not have words on that particular song. And that's how we bridge the gap, because my 5-year-old daughter will listen to a Katy Perry song and she understands the form of that song. And we take it, then take the violin and maybe a completely instrumental song, and we give it to her in that same form so she can pretty much understand it immediately.
And this is what the kids are picking up on. They may be intimidated when you pull those instruments out of the cases, but when you start doing that ABA thing, they go, oh.
Exactly. It's very relatable, and that's the thing. And we perform for the kids. I mean, they go absolutely crazy, not only because we're doing something that seems impossible. I mean, we're taking an art form, taking a violin, and we're playing hip-hop on top of it. You know what I mean? To them, it's just like, man, this is crazy. This is cool. So I think what we're trying to do is just look at it in a different way so the kids can kind of look at the violin and not be intimidated and might possibly want to play it. And, you know, kids that would never necessarily listen to a Bach piece or a Beethoven or whatever, they can listen to that piece and appreciate it.
What if I was just coming upon you, you know, summer stoop afternoon, and I come around the corner and I hear these two violinists playing in a way that I never heard before? Can you pick up your instruments and just do something that would say to me, whoa, these guys are good, but they're also speaking to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Could you do that improvisationally?
Oh, that's what we do.
But let's see it. Yeah, go ahead. Pick it up.
Yeah. So, you know, you think of it, some people think of it as improvisation. We completely think of it as freestyling.
Yeah.
So we're just going to make up something. We haven't talked about it, rehearsed it, you know. And what we'll do is one of us will kind of create a bass, and then the other person will kind of riff off of it.
You want a beat?
Oh, no, we'll make our own.
I can give you a beat.
Style. Oh, that was great. Yeah. That was so good.
Thanks.
That was so nice.
That's like our favorite thing to do. I mean, we do it every night on stage because we play so many shows that, like, just for us, we want to do something brand new and fresh every night, just, you know, and it kind of puts you on the spot and it gets your blood going. And it's also the purest form of expression because, like we were saying before, when you grow up playing the violin, you know, you're taught to, you know, sit up straight and make sure that you, you know, play classical music at the tip, you know, more romantic music, you play it at the frog. You know, and make sure that you sustain, you know, not too much portato on most things. You're really not taught to just pick up your instrument and play whatever you feel, you know?
Which gets me to my question here. So you guys were taught to sit up straight, play the violin. Where'd that come from?
Public school system. We met in high school. I was in 10th grade. He was in 9th grade. And we were stand partners in orchestra class the first day of school in 1996. And that's when we met in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in a magnet school program. Our parents didn't have money. We weren't having lessons. We just had a second period every day. We had orchestra. And we had a teacher that just cared. And, you know, he just kind of pushed us. And, you know, we lived in a neighborhood where it seemed like the only way to get out the hood would be to football or basketball or just the normal things. And he always told us, is like, you know, if you come here second period every day and you work hard and you take it home and you practice, that you can do anything. And he was right, man. We got full scholarships to college, and it's just, you know, the type of thing that keeps opening doors for us. Gosh. And
That's so great.
So it's great. And now we get to keep trying to push the envelope and show people something else that they didn't think was possible. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
What do you feel is your responsibility as an artist to speak to kids beyond the question of how to get out of the hood or how to get rich or how to be responsible to your community, to your people, to your family, to the things you love?
You know, I think as artists, and this is just me personally, I think as artists, it's our responsibility to talk to these kids and not think it's a burden. I think a lot of artists think it's a burden. I don't want kids to really look at me and look at me in a way that's like, I look up to this guy. But sometimes it's not even really a choice. I mean, you're a public figure. Kids look at you. You know, they want to be you. So, you know, and you're human too. You're going to make mistakes. I mean, I think admitting to your mistakes is good too. Kids can kind of see that and learn from that.
Kev Marcus and Will B, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Kev Marcus and Will B are the duo behind the group Black Violin. Their album Stereotypes is out this September. To see a video of Kev Marcus and Will B performing in our New York City studios, visit thetakeaway.org. That's all from us today. We want to thank Colorado Public Broadcasting for freestyling with us. We're broadcasting live from sunny Denver tomorrow and Wednesday. Thanks so much for listening, and keep listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.